If they hit the wrong one, they get scared and quickly leave that note in search of the right one. That's what you were doing when you were trying to find the key. If you make friends with whichever note you happen to land on, it will give you directions to where you are trying to go. Most inexperienced bass players have to find the root before they can play anything else. That is a very elementary way of thinking. When I asked you to play earlier, you didn't listen to what you played. You only listened for the root, and when you didn't hit it on your first try, you jumped around blindly until you found it. Now listen, there are how many notes in Western music?
12.
How many notes are there in most of the key signatures we play in?
7.
Correct. In any key, there are 7 so-called right notes, which leave only 5 so-called wrong notes. What this means is even if we don't know what key we are in and guess which note to play, we will be right more than half the time. Look,
he continued, pointing at the keyboard.
In the key of C major, the rule book states that you're allowed to play the white keys only. But what would happen if you accidentally landed on a black key? Nothing. Because if you look on either side of this wrong note, what do you see?
A right note, I answered proudly.
Absolutely. You are never more than a half step away from a right note. Never. So what are you so afraid of? You can't be lost. If you land on a wrong note, just step off of it in either direction, and you're right again. I once was lost, but now am found. Even if I close my eyes and throw a dart at the keyboard, I will hit a right note more than half the time. Was blind, but now I see.
His way of looking at notes caused me to see them in a new way. If I was never more than a half step away from a right note, like Michael had said, my world would be much easier. That was a relief. Michael read my thoughts, perhaps literally.
This is liberating, is it not? The real beauty is this. If you use your ears and listen to that accidental note, you may find that it actually sounds better than the right note you intended to play.
He walked back over to the guitar and started playing a simple groove. He looked at me, talking while he played.
Don't be afraid of the notes. Jump right in. All I want you to do is listen to whether the note is in the key or not. If the note is in, listen to it and realize where you are in relationship to the root. If the note is out, slide your finger 1 fret in either direction and voila, you're right again.
I picked up my bass and, without thinking, played the first note my finger landed on. It sounded horrible, so I quickly slid my finger down 1 fret. Michael was correct. I was now on a right note, and it sounded good. I wanted to test this theory, so I played the same wrong note again, but this time I slid my finger up 1 fret. Like before, I was on a right note. It made me smile. I also noticed something else. I wasn't sure as yet that it was really happening, so I repeated the process a few more times. I then found a different wrong note to start on and repeated the whole process. What I noticed shocked me. I started to tell him what I'd discovered. Seeing the expression on my face, he spoke first.
Go ahead, tell me.
It was difficult to explain, but I gave it a try. I noticed that when I went from the wrong notes to the right notes over and over again, it made the wrong notes gradually sound right. The more I did it, the righter the wrong notes started to sound, until they didn't sound wrong at all anymore.
Why? Why didn't those notes sound wrong anymore?
Maybe it's because the wrong notes are leading somewhere. Repeating the wrong note allows the listener to know where it's going so that it begins to sound right. I confused myself. It surprised me that Michael understood what I had just said.
Very nice.
He was smiling now.
I call this massaging the notes. It's a great way to correct mistakes after they've already been made. I like to think of it as a way to change the past.
I like that.
I've got a million of them. You can also play the right notes so much that they start to sound wrong. Overusing a note can sound just as bad as playing a wrong note. Basically, every note has something to say. They all lead somewhere if you just listen to them. How you use them is the key. As I said before, the notes will tell you where they want to go. You just have to listen.
I know that I don't listen that way.
I noticed. Many musicians study so much music theory that they only remember how to tell the notes where to go. They have learned to forget that notes are alive. I urge you to listen to the notes. They may have something to tell you.
I never thought about listening to notes that way, to see what they had to tell me. I'd always tried to tell the notes where to go, and most of the time they seemed to resist.
Let me hold your bass.
Michael took my bass and handed me the guitar. He asked me to play the same chords he'd been playing. Before I had to ask, he let me off the hook by telling me what they were. G minor to C7. The guitar didn't sound the same in my hands as it did in his, but I did my best. He asked if I could play and listen at the same time. I said that I could. Michael started from the highest note on my bass and moved down one fret at a time, playing every note on the instrument. He then did the same thing in reverse, starting from the lowest note and ending at the highest. It was simple, but against the chords I was playing, it sounded amazing. I'd never heard that done before. I'd also never heard my bass sound that good. My old Univox, which I'd always thought of as beat up, suddenly came to life. And all he'd done was play a chromatic scale. I knew that many of the notes he played were not in the key signature and shouldn't have sounded that good. But somehow he made them all work. I was astounded at what I was hearing.
Which of those notes sounded bad?
None of them did, I replied, still in shock.
Why?
Because you were playing them and not me.
The first truthful thing you said all day. You graduate. Class over.
No, really. I don't know why all the notes sounded good. I guess it was how you played them that made them work.
Right again. Now, how did I play them?
I don't know. I guess you... I couldn't think of an appropriate answer at first, and then it hit me. I had the answer, and I knew it. It was so simple that I was surprised that I'd never thought of it before that day. I didn't even feel proud of myself for coming up with the answer, because I should have known it immediately. You didn't just rely on the notes alone. You added in more of the other elements of music. I knew that I was right, so I answered with my own smile of complete confidence.
Progress.
I heard him whisper, almost to himself.
We are making progress.
For the next few hours, we played music together, often switching between bass and guitar. What he showed me was remarkably simple. Every once in a while, he would use the keyboard to demonstrate something else about notes. His proficiency on that instrument was just as stunning as it was on the guitar and the bass. The only thing that surprised me more was the fact that, until that day, I didn't know that the keyboard still worked. Until that day, I wasn't sure if my brain still worked either. But I was starting to get it. I was actually understanding what the crazy man was showing me. We massaged notes, listened to notes, directed notes, and just played notes until I was familiar and comfortable with all of them. He had me spend time with the chromatic scale, one note at a time, listening to what each had to say about the key we were in. Then he would change keys and have me repeat the whole process. Each note would say something different as the chord changed. That exercise was a revelation to me. Another exercise involved playing notes randomly without thinking of what I was going to play first. Just play any note, he instructed. Jump all over the bass as if you don't care. I was surprised at how hard it was to do. I had a difficult time not playing patterns. My fingers kept landing on top of the frets instead of in between them. Mistakes, he told me, are just things we didn't mean to play. It doesn't mean they are wrong. Some of the best music I've ever played started out as a mistake. Mistakes usually throw us off because the note comes out before we think about it. We can't avoid making mistakes, but we can get comfortable with them, especially if we practice making them. The thought of practicing mistakes was another strange but interesting idea. I had no idea how I was supposed to practice that. Michael answered my thought.
This random exercise simulates making mistakes so that they no longer affect us negatively. If we learn to play random notes cleanly, playing any pre-thought note or pattern will be a piece of cake.
I was learning things I'd never learned before, and it was exciting. My mind was open and receptive to everything he had to say. Well, almost everything. It was exactly what I needed.
Play like a child with an air guitar. A child playing air guitar never plays a wrong note.
For the first time in a long time, I played like a child. I loved it. Measure 3, articulation, duration.
Every time you move, and every time you play a note, a piece of yourself is left behind.
We played for hours, just the two of us having fun. I don't remember the last time I'd done that without expecting to get paid. Eager to learn more, I asked Michael to teach me about the other elements of music.
Soon, I have more to show you about notes first. Let's look at them in a different way before we call it a night. How we view notes provides a good example of how we view life.
How we view life? What do you mean? He played a C and a C sharp at the same time on the guitar.
How does that sound?
Awful. It sounds like two notes clashing. I responded with a grimace.
Very ordinary answer. Now, if I take the C up an octave and play the two notes again, what does it sound like now?
Now it sounds pretty. The C became the major seventh, which is the key factor in making a chord sound pretty. That's cool.
Correct. The rule book tells us that two notes played side by side, a half step apart, should clash and sound dissonant. But if we move the lower note up an octave, the same two notes sound pretty. Why is that? They are the same two notes, so how can they clash in one instance and sound pretty in the next? There is a life lesson in there somewhere.
Interesting, I thought. So are you saying that situations in life which seem to clash may not be wrong at all? They may just be in the wrong octave?
It is you who is saying that, but I do agree. Keep going with that thought.
Okay. I've never thought about it before, but I'll give it a try. How about this? If we can learn to change our perspective and see negative things in a different octave, we may be able to see the beauty in all things and in all situations.
Bravo. I'll accept that. Very articulate, simple, and to the point. All situations and all people contain beauty, but it is up to us to see it. When we don't see it, our immediate response is to blame, then change the outer thing rather than change our perspective or our octave. It is only when we change octave that we can see things as they really are. Then, and only then, can we make a positive change when and where it needs to be made.
Once again, I was learning new things about music and life. I was fascinated by the way he paralleled the two. I didn't know what I was getting myself into when I originally agreed to take part in this situation. But if he really meant it when he told me that he could teach me nothing, he sure had me fooled. Even though I just met him, he was already the best teacher I'd ever known, bringing out parts of me I never knew existed.
Here's another way to look at these two notes. Let's say that we don't change the octave of the C or the C sharp. Let's just surround these two notes with other notes and see what happens. If you play a B-flat, a C, a D-flat, which is the same as a C-sharp, an F, and an A-flat, you have a B flat minor 9 chord. Now, the C and the C sharp sound good even though they are right next to each other and in the same register. People could learn a life lesson from music if they would just choose to see.
He started singing a familiar song.
Johnny Nash,
I responded, recognizing the lyric.
That's a beautiful song.
He nodded in agreement.
Also, in the key of B-flat minor, the rule book tells us that we are not allowed to play a C-sharp. But when I play it, it sounds good to me. We're supposed to call it a D-flat. Even though they are the same note, we can play one, but not the other. It's all in the name, I guess. Rules.
They can be confusing sometimes. Michael told me that once the rules were thoroughly learned, they could be thoroughly broken. He said that the same was true with life's rules. I eventually witnessed him break or bend rules many times. Most of the time, I hadn't even realized what the rule was. I just knew that one or two of them were being broken. He also told me that the beauty of the world could be seen through music. There is always beauty to be found.
And it is necessary to find it in all things and in all people if real change is to be made in this world.
He seemed to think that what we see in life and what we hear in music are simply our choice, and that when things start to look grim, that is when we really need to find beauty. I remember his telling me, it is always easier to build upon this beauty
than it is to pretend it is not there and try to create it from scratch.
That is a comment I will never forget. I've had many music lessons in my life, but never before had I experienced anything quite like Michael. None of my teachers had ever shown life through music in a way that I could clearly understand. Even though I didn't totally understand Michael, he made things clearer than they had ever appeared before, and he wasn't finished. He was just getting started. He played two more notes on the guitar and asked me how they sounded. Again, they seemed to clash, but this time I was afraid to say so. He could tell by my expression what I was thinking. Next, he played what sounded like two different notes. I could hear a slight wobble as they vibrated against each other. These two notes sounded better, and I told him so. He told me that they were the same two notes. I didn't believe him.
Those were the same two notes?
Absolutely. I just articulated them differently the second time. I also held them a bit longer. Changing the duration allows your ear to hear and respond differently.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that the way you played the notes caused them to sound different? I mean, even the pitch sounded different.
Michael didn't respond. He just walked over to my bookshelf, pulled out another CD, and placed it in the player. With the remote in his hand, he sat down and looked at me in silence. I had no idea what he was up to or what his musical choice would be this time. The anticipation was starting to build. He just sat there staring at me with his sly grin. When he knew that I was uncomfortable enough, he pointed the remote and pressed play. The music that came out of the speaker shocked me. I didn't know who it was. It was a CD I surely didn't believe to be part of my collection. It felt like Michael was trying to torture me. The music was, well, it was bluegrass. I hate bluegrass music.
All the talk about beauty, and that's all you have to say?
Well, that's the first thing that came to mind.
What are you talking about?
He pressed pause on the remote.
Bluegrass.
No, you were not talking about bluegrass. You were talking about yourself.
Michael leaned forward as he spoke. His dark eyebrows nearly touched each other as he narrowed his gaze.
Listen to what you're saying. I hate bluegrass music. You were talking about you, but blaming your lack of perception on this particular style of music.
Even though he was right, I felt as though he was attacking me, and he didn't stop. He continued his assault.
We do the same with people. All music, like all people, contains beauty and a soul. For you not to recognize it is not music's fault. It is you we are talking about. It is you who does not recognize. There are millions of people who love this music. Are you here to tell me that all these people are wrong?
I'm not saying that they're wrong. I just don't like bluegrass music.
Who are you talking about?
Me.
Good. More progress.
Michael sat back and closed his eyes, smiling as if he'd just won a battle. Without looking, he pushed play and nodded his head at me. I started to pick up my bass so I could play along, but with his eyes still closed, he tucked his long hair behind his right ear and whispered,
"Listen. Just listen."
I didn't know what he wanted me to listen for, but I figured that if I acted like him, maybe I could listen like him. So I leaned back and closed my eyes too. After a few minutes, Michael spoke.
"Blue Moon of Kentucky" by Bill Monroe. He is the father of bluegrass music. Listen to the bass on this track. Can you play like that?
Of course I can. Country music is easy to play. 1-5-1-4, no problem.
First of all, this is bluegrass. There is a difference. It is closely related to country music, but it is also related to jazz. They're kissing cousins. You may not hear it yet, but you will one day. Some of the best improvisers on the planet play bluegrass, and playing it may not be as simple as you think.
Now, I admit that I hadn't listened to much bluegrass or country music in the past, so maybe he was right. I couldn't hear it. But there was one point I really felt he was wrong about. I knew this type of music was easy to play, no matter what he said. It only took a few minutes for me to realize that, once again, Michael was right. He introduced me to the nuances of the music by asking me to pay close attention to how the bass player articulated each note in that particular song. There was much more to Mr. Monroe's music than I'd previously realized. I didn't know how to feel about that.
Notice how each note starts and ends. Listen to the way he attacks each note and notice whether the notes are long, short, or in between. Recognize the life of each note. Can you hear the beginning, middle, and end of each one? If he had articulated differently or changed the duration of any note, would that have changed the feel of the song? Listen.
Again, Michael sat back and closed his eyes, so I did the same. I tried to pay attention to the life of each note. The song was in 3/4. I noticed that the bass player was playing whole notes, except that he didn't let each note ring for its full duration. He would cut them off just before each downbeat. I also realized that if the notes had been any shorter, the song would have had a little more bounce, and if they were any longer, the song would have felt slower. The relationship between the slow 3/4 time signature and Bill's rhythmic way of singing gave the song an interesting feel. Also, the attack of the acoustic bass felt different than an electric bass would have felt. How the bass player played each note helped dictate the feel of the song. It made me think of how I usually approached my notes. I rarely let them ring. I usually attacked them hard and fast. I thought about each note having a life, as Michael had alluded. Listening to the bass player caused me to realize that I rarely gave my notes enough air. But the most amazing thing was that in allowing myself to listen to Bill Monroe so deeply, I enjoyed his music, if only slightly. I opened my eyes and noticed Michael staring at me. Stopping the music, he asked a strange question.
"You ever read Horton Hears a Who?"
I didn't know what that had to do with anything, but understanding that Michael had his own way of teaching, I answered him.
"Of course I have. Dr. Seuss."
"Do you remember what that poor elephant found on the little speck of dust?"
"There was a whole civilization living on it."
"Exactly,"
he said, pointing at me.
"Notes are the same. If you listen closely, you can find a whole world living inside each one. Notes are alive, and like you and me, they need to breathe. The song will dictate how much air is needed. There is no rule hard and fast, but usually the sharper the attack, the shorter the sustain. The vice versa is also true. Now here's what I want you to do this time. Breathe with the music. Listen to the song one more time and take a breath with each note as the bass player plays. It will help you understand what I'm talking about. After that, I want you to play along with the song, breathing with your own bass notes. If you change the length of your notes, you must also change the length of your breath. Do that and pay attention to what it does to you and to music. Don't go to sleep tonight until you've done it at least twice. We will continue tomorrow. I will leave my bag here, if that's okay with you.
Without waiting for a response, Michael put on his helmet, pulled down the face shield, turned and walked out the front door, skateboard in hand. For a time, I just sat there staring at the closed door, reflecting on the many things the strange man had said. I'd already learned so much from him. It was hard to believe that we'd met for the first time earlier that day. Breathe with the music, he had instructed. What did he mean? I never listened to or played music in such a fashion. But once I did as he'd suggested, things started to change. Breathing with the music caused me to hear it and feel it in a way I'd never had before. I could actually feel the notes mixing with my heartbeat. It was like a meditation. I don't know if it was my slow rhythmic breathing or what, but whatever it was helped me to begin to understand Mr. Monroe's music for the first time. And I hate to say it, but I liked it. That Michael. He was a sneaky character. At least 10 minutes had gone by before I realized I was actually learning how to play a bluegrass song. In order to play along while breathing with my notes, I had to learn the music. He tricked me into doing something I would have outright refused to do if I'd been asked. I knew that he must have been smiling right about then. I was. As I got up to go to bed, I saw Michael's bag lying on the floor as if it had fallen off the arm of the chair. Sticking halfway out of the bag was a book. I tried to leave it alone, but what I could see of the title made me curious. The Science and Art of... I couldn't see the rest, but I really wanted to. I wasn't sure whether I should remove the book from his bag or not. I didn't want to go through his stuff, but the book was already halfway out, and my curiosity was getting the best of me. I didn't know why, but it was. Just peeking at the title wouldn't be wrong, right? I tried to distract myself by going into the bathroom to brush my teeth, but it didn't work. The Science and Art of... Of what? I asked out loud. Okay, just a quick look, I told myself. I practically ran from the bathroom to the bag. I guess I was secretly hoping for something different, but the bag was still lying there in the exact same place, with the book poking halfway out. Michael is so peculiar, I thought, trying to come up with an excuse. I may never see him again anyway. Plus, he might have left it here on purpose, just for me to find. I convinced myself a quick glance would be all right. The Science and Art of... Tracking by Tom Brown Jr. I was confused. It was a book on animal and human tracking. I couldn't quite fathom what Michael was doing with a book about footprints, but it looked interesting. Tracking was an interest that I had held since my childhood days of pretending to be a spy, but I never really learned much about it. I am familiar with a trumpet player named Tom Brown, and quite frankly, even though I love his music, I'm not sure if I would have read a book about him. But Tom Brown Jr., the tracker? Let's see. About an hour later, I forced myself to stop reading. Not wanting Michael to know I touched his things, I put the book back using my best James Bond spy skills. He'll never know, I whispered to myself as if someone might hear. With my mind tired and full, I went to sleep and slept hard. For a little while, anyway. I awoke to the sound of banging on my front door. I looked at the clock, 5:15 a.m. I don't know any musician who gets up at 5:15 in the morning, so I rolled over and tried to go back to sleep. Then I heard his voice.
Let me in! Let me in! I can't find the key!
I could hear him laughing through the front door. I got up and opened the door. I had to admit that Michael was funny, but I wasn't going to encourage him by cracking even a faint smile. I gave him my best sleepy look. He didn't seem to care. He walked right in wearing a pair of brown shorts, a forest green shirt, large black boots, and a tan safari hat.
Around his waist was a small pack, and he was carrying his skateboard under his left arm.
Time to go.
I couldn't imagine going anywhere that early except back to sleep.
Go where?
Tracking. But we have to move quickly. The sun is just starting to rise, and it will be at the perfect angle soon. Did you read the book?
No, I didn't. What book? I didn't plan to lie. The words just popped out of my mouth. I also didn't know what to think. Was he baiting me with the book, or were my spy skills that lacking? He looked at me and smiled one of his now familiar Cheshire Cat grins. Picking up a shirt from the floor, he threw it at me and turned toward the door.
Let's go.
Slowly starting to wake up, I put on the shirt and followed him. You got room on that board for me?
It might take longer, but we would see much more.
He responded in all seriousness. We hopped in my car and drove west on Interstate 40. Nashville is the type of city that attracts people from all over the country, especially musicians. It's not too big or too small. This allows people from larger cities, such as Los Angeles or New York, to sell their small homes, move to Nashville, buy larger ones with lots of land, and still not be too far away from city life. I like it because you only have to drive a few minutes to be surrounded by trees. I've always loved spending time in the woods, but my musical life never allowed me the opportunity. At least that's what my excuse had always been. I dreamed of someday owning a log cabin in the woods. We drove down a beautiful winding road in Cheatham County that was flanked by rolling hills on the east and the long, narrow Harpeth River on the west. The scenery was beautiful at that time of day. The low morning sun shining through the trees and reflecting off the remaining white oak and hickory leaves filled the air with magic. The dark rippling river slithered and twisted like a snake, tempting us to take a bite of the forbidden fruit that lay just on the other side. I was instructed to park the car on the right side of the road near one of the bends in the river. Then we walked up a steep, rarely used trail to the top of Mace Bluff. Mace Bluff is a tall hill covered in scrub pine and cedar trees that overlook the river. The ground cover, mostly poison ivy, is so thick it acts like a barrier protecting the mountain. Few casual strollers would risk a trek through it. At the top of the hill is a low-sitting flat rock with a carving in the center. This ancient carving is known as the Mace Bluff Petroglyph. Researchers have wondered about the carving for years, but have never come to a conclusion as to what it is. All they know is that its origins are Native American and that it is hundreds of years old. All I know is that the panoramic view from the top of the bluff is breathtaking. Michael stood with his eyes closed and his hands raised above his head. He took three slow, deep breaths. I didn't know what I was supposed to do, so I just stood there watching. I could tell that this was a sacred place to him, and I waited for him to tell me about it. I especially wanted to know about the carving in the rock. Instead, when he was finished breathing, he sat down on top of the carving as if it weren't there, and pointed across the river.
Look through the trees. That's an area called Mound Bottom. It was a sacred place, used by Native Americans hundreds of years ago. Some of those natives still come back to that place today.
I didn't know if he was talking about living Native Americans or spirits from the distant past. I hadn't seen many Native Americans in Nashville, so if spirits were still hanging around, I wondered how he could know. Could he see them, feel them, or was he just playing with my mind again? He was supposed to be teaching music anyway, so I didn't ask. I counted 13 different sized mounds surrounding one big mound situated in the middle. The big one was said to be at least 20 feet high. They were spread across a broad, open field, and from our vantage point, they looked as if they were but small bumps on the land. It was hard to believe that they were really that large.
Those are notes, big notes,
Michael said, nodding across the river to the mounds.
What do you mean?
Signs left by the native people. Those mounds are like big notes, but you have to be far away from them in order to read them as a group. Tom Brown Jr. is a tracker, so he would call them tracks, I am a musician, so I call them notes. If a good tracker can tell a lot about the people who left those tracks, a good musician should be able to do the same.
After a few minutes of musical mound contemplation, Michael broke the silence.
Reading tracks is like reading music, just as making tracks is like making music. There's no way to move across the landscape without leaving tracks. It matters not whether it is a natural landscape or a musical one. Every time you move, and every time you play a note, a piece of yourself is left behind. There's no way to avoid that. Now the tracker,
he explained, continuing to gaze upon the field,
if he is a good one, can see right into the soul of whoever left the tracks. The tracker can tell what the creator of the tracks was thinking, feeling, doing, and more. A good musician should be able to do the same. To learn how to do that takes time, dedication, and intuition. But since you can read music already, it should come to you easily.
I had heard of reading palms, tea leaves, hair follicles, and eyes. And Brown's book even talked about reading tracks. But never before had I heard of reading music. At least, not in this way.
Take a good look at these mounds,
Michael instructed, waving his hand across the horizon.
Seeing them as a whole is a lot like looking at a piece of music. A good reader can get an idea of what a piece of music sounds like just by looking at the whole chart. Now, to get more detail from the music, we need to move closer. Let's go!
Without hesitation, he took off running down the hill. He bounced down the small mountain like a deer, and I tried my best to keep up. By the time I made it to the bottom, Michael was already crossing the river and heading over to the mounds. When I finally caught up with him, he was standing on top of the large mound, which I now noticed was flattened on top, forming a small plateau. From this vantage point, we could clearly see how the smaller mounds were situated in a horseshoe shape around the largest mound.
The key.
What?
The key. You found it. You are standing on it. Can you see how this mound is like the key center of a piece of music? Everything else is here to support this larger mound.
I see, I replied, struggling to understand. Let me try. The large mound we are standing on is like the key of the song. All the other mounds are here to help define what that key is. This large mound had to be established first before the other mounds, or let me say the other notes, could be placed. It's clear, standing here in the center, that the smaller mounds are here to help support this larger one. So, relating these mounds to music, I can see that the first thing to do is establish a key. How was that?
Very good. But like I mentioned before, the first thing might not be the key.
Right, the groove. But in this situation, we're talking about mounds. Wait a minute. Are you saying that the natives first established a groove before building the mounds?
Yes.
How so? I imagined native people dancing to the music while building the mounds. I knew that wasn't what he was talking about, but I couldn't make the connection. At least, not yet.
What did they think about before placing the mounds here?
I tried to come up with an answer, but the pure act of trying seemed to push it away. I don't know.
You search for answers the way you search for notes. Let go of the need to be in charge.
I didn't quite grasp what he was talking about, but I did try to relax. It didn't help. I still couldn't find the answer. Can you give me a hint?
Tomorrow, we will build an exact replica of this mound in your backyard, okay?
Why? I asked, not following his logic.
Finally! I thought you would never get the answer.
What are you talking about? I was really confused.
You don't even get the answers when they come to you. Maybe you are more pitiful than I thought.
Michael lowered his head. I could tell he was trying to conceal his laughter by the way his head bounced. I threw my hands up in frustration. I still don't get it.
Why?
Feeling more than frustrated, I had to keep myself from shouting. I don't know why.
No, listen. They needed a why, a reason before they placed the mounds. They didn't just decide to place the mounds in this specific area one day. They had a reason for doing it. Then they decided where to place them. Where to place the mounds is the key. Why to place them in the first place is the groove.
Okay, now I get it. That should have been easy. Of course they had a reason to place the mounds here. They needed the reason why before they decided where to place them, and not the other way around. I understand that clearly now.
Yes, and now you can see how purpose was their groove, right?
Yes, I can. So what was their purpose for placing the mounds here?
Let's look closer and see what ideas come to us.
He reached in his waist pack and pulled out a handful of popsicle sticks. I had no idea what they were for. He started walking around the large mound, poking the sticks into the ground. By the time he was finished, there were rows of sticks going up and down the mound in all directions.
Look here. What do you see?
He was pointing at the ground.
Grass, I answered, only half joking.
He got down on his knees and motioned for me to do the same. Placing his hands in the grass, he parted the blades carefully.
Think Tom Brown.
I answered immediately.
A track. I see it.
Yes, deer tracks on top of the mounds, out here in the open.
He replied as he stood up.
Each one of these rows of sticks marks the trail of a different animal coming to the top of this mound.
I see the sticks, but I'm having trouble seeing the tracks.
If you were in a room and tuned your mind to the color blue, every blue thing in the room would jump out at you. All you have to do here is tune your mind to the appearance of the track I just showed you. Then, like the color blue, the rest of the tracks will appear.
I knew what he was talking about. I'd done it with colors many times before. I could cause myself to recognize any color in a room just by thinking of that color. As soon as I would focus my mind, everything in the room that was even close to the same color I was thinking of would stand out. By focusing on a different color, I could cause that color to stand out. I decided to try it with the track. I looked down and focused on the deer track at our feet. It was a shade darker than the rest of the grass. I unfocused my eyes and looked around the mound using my peripheral vision. To my surprise, I could see rows of little dark circles all over the mound.
I see them.
Of course you do. There are animal tracks all over these mounds. Tell me this. Why do you think these animals are risking their safety to come here? There's no food or water here. And on top of the mound, they're out in the open, where they do not like to be. What draws them to this location?
Maybe there's something here for the animals that we don't see.
Precisely. And maybe there was something here for the native people, too. And maybe there's something here for us, but we just can't see it. What we can't see, but know is there, is usually called what?
Spirit.
Exactly. Spirit. The sensed, but unseen. Music is the same. Can you see music? No? Then what is it really, I ask you?
I had heard of the idea of music being spiritual, but he put it in a way that made sense to me. All of a sudden, without waiting for me to answer his last question, Michael ripped off his boots and took off down the hill, running on all fours like an animal. It was a hilarious sight. He bounced up and down, back and forth. Turning and darting like he lost his mind, he scampered all over the mound. I'd seen squirrels act like that, but never a human. I could see the enjoyment on his face. His eyes beamed like a young pup's seeing his first snow. It looked like fun to me, too, but I didn't have the courage to join him. After removing the popsicle sticks from one of the rows, he laid them down beside each track, then motioned for me to join him near the bottom of the hill. Of course, I walked.
Look, musical manuscript.
What do you mean?
If you allow the track to become the note and the stick to become the stem, each track will look like a musical note. You can then read the animal's gait pattern like a piece of music.
Cool.
Also, noticing how the animal's feet attack the ground will tell you even more about the animal. Usually, the sharper the attack of each foot, the shorter the length of time it spends on the ground. This is a lot like music.
I learned from the tracking book that gates were how you could tell whether the animal was moving fast or slow, and that looking at the edges of the track could tell you about the animal's direction and intention. After Michael showed me how to read each group of deer tracks like a measure of music, I could do just that. I could tell instantly that the deer was galloping if the tracks sharply hit the ground in groups of four. Tracks in groups of two meant that the deer was moving more slowly. It came to me suddenly that the same is true in music. Four notes in a measure versus two notes in a measure lets you know how quickly the notes are moving, even at a glance. The fact that the deer ran across the field but walked on top of the open mound let me know that they were comfortable there. Paying attention to how the distinct edges of deer hooves hit the ground enabled me to tell in advance when the animal was going to change directions. I had no idea how Michael could predict those direction changes before he showed me what to look for. Now that I could do it, I felt like Sherlock Holmes. He showed me how to tell which way an animal was looking based on how its feet hit the ground. He also told me that if we looked deeper into the tracks, we could look deeper into the track maker. Michael believed that many internal things could be discerned about an animal or a human by studying his tracks. I didn't know what he meant by internal, but what he'd already shown me was enough. Being able to tell so much just by looking at the ground seemed magical to me. I could only imagine what it must be like having the ability to do the same thing by listening to someone's music. A sad person often plays music in a minor key, while a major key might suggest a happy mood. That I already knew. I could even tell when a person was extremely nervous just by listening to his music. Maybe, like tracks, music is a doorway allowing one to peek into a person's spirit. The thought of that was really intriguing. I was excited to learn more.
This is a spiritual place.
Michael spoke after we galloped our way back to the top of the hill.
The natives know it. The animals know it. And now, you know it.
But what's your proof? How do you know that this is a spiritual place more than any other place?
Proof? What is proof but someone's perspective? And tell me, what importance does proof have anyway? Did you learn from the experience? Now that is important.
But what makes it more spiritual than any other place?
I didn't say that this place was more spiritual than any other place. I said that it is a spiritual place, and the natives know it. Think about this. You looked at this place from high atop Mace Bluff, and you saw beauty. You then came and stood atop the largest mound, and you saw beauty. And now, you look into the mound at the tracks of the animals that walk across her face, and still, you see beauty. Now close your eyes and tell me what you see.
I did as he asked, and again saw beauty.
Good. From four different perspectives, you have viewed this wonderful place, and each view has generated the same feeling. Beauty. How can you be wrong? Beauty is something you experience, not something you prove. Can you tell me what beauty is? Or can you only give me your perspective on it? Can science define beauty? Can you see or touch it? Or can you just see and touch something that possesses its quality? Beauty is invisible, individual, and intangible. Interesting, isn't it? It is something you know, yet technically, it is not there. How can this be? Like music, it lives inside you, and you impress its qualities on whatever you choose. People have spoken about beauty for centuries. A wise man in the 1800s once said, "The beautiful is that in which the many, still seen as many, become one." There is truth in that statement. But in simpler terms, it could be stated as another wise man did. He wrote, "Beauty is truth. Truth, beauty." That is easily understandable.
Standing up straight, he spread his arms wide and closed his eyes.
The natives knew and still know that this is a spiritual place because they choose it to be. And you have chosen the same. And nestled here in the bend of the beautiful Harpeth River, you can see why.
He quickly opened his eyes and leaned forward, asking me one last question.
If this place is beautiful, and beauty is invisible, then what is this place?
A spiritual place.
Thank you. Now we can go.
Measure 4, Technique. Are you using magic?
Yes, I am. It's called technique.
I was speechless. I stood there for a moment, letting his words linger in my mind. A breeze blew across my face as he turned and walked away. It chilled my skin. Somehow, I felt his words were connected to the breeze. I can't explain it, but it was as if his message was carried through the air and into my ears by the wind. And like the wind, it hit before I could see it coming. After retrieving our popsicle sticks, we didn't speak another word all the way back to the car. When we arrived, Michael broke the silence.
Watch.
I hadn't noticed, but he had picked up two small pieces of wood. One was a straight, thin, round stick, about 14 inches long. The other was a short, flat board, a little thicker than the stick. He knelt down on one knee, placing the flat board on the ground. Holding the board down with his foot, he held the longer stick between his palms, perpendicular to the flat board, forming an upside-down T. By rapidly rubbing his palms together, he rolled the thin stick back and forth. With his body leaning over his hands, providing downward pressure, he caused the stick to rub and spin back and forth against the board, creating friction and heat. Within a few seconds, the wood started smoking. A few seconds later, he stopped rolling the stick.
Look.
I looked down, and there was a red-hot coal lying beside the flat board. After allowing me a good look, he transferred the coal onto a pile of dry grasses. Then he gently picked up the pile and blew on it 3 times. During his third breath, the whole thing burst into flames right in his hands. It was both amazing and beautiful to watch. Michael told me that what he'd used was called a hand drill. I'd seen someone make a fire using that technique once before on a television show, but I'd never seen anything quite like what Michael demonstrated. The whole process took less than 1 minute, and if he hadn't stopped to let me watch, it would have probably taken less than 30 seconds. A year or so later, I practiced making fire using the hand drill and bow drill techniques. It was not easy to do. To make a fire in that short amount of time still seems nearly impossible. After holding the flaming bundle for a few seconds, Michael tossed it on the ground and looked at me.
Your turn,
he suggested as he stamped out the flames.
Okay, I'll give it a try.
I knelt down and did my best to repeat what I'd just seen, practically mangling the two pieces of wood in the process. The stick in my hands kept wobbling back and forth, slipping off the flat board on the ground. After about 2 minutes of struggling, I was exhausted. I dropped the stick and sat back, tired and sweaty. Michael chuckled, picked up the stick, and had the wood smoking again within a few seconds.
How'd you do that?
I asked, still out of breath. Are you using magic? I was only half joking.
Yes, I am. It's called technique. Without proper technique, nothing can happen.
Can you teach me the proper technique for making a fire?
I asked, forgetting one of his first rules.
No, I can't.
He answered with his familiar sly grin.
Why not? Oh, right. Will you show me the proper technique, please?
I was slowly adapting to his style of teaching.
I would be delighted.
We knelt down, and he showed me how and where to place my hands and feet. He told me that the reason the stick, made of horseweed, was wobbling against the cedar board was that I was favoring my stronger hand.
Use both hands equally. Most musicians favor their stronger hand. They may never realize it,
but if the problem is not corrected, it will surely hinder their progress. And here,
he said, pointing at the sticks,
if the problem is not corrected, you will never make a fire.
After a few more starts and stops, corrections and adjustments, I had smoke. It wasn't much, but it was smoke. Michael laughed and told me that I was sweating so much while attempting to start a fire, I would likely put out my coal before I could ever ignite a flame. I fell back on the ground, spent and breathing hard. Michael spoke so that I didn't have to.
To play music, good technique is a must. You can know all the notes in the world. You can have the best ideas in the world. But you need good technique to get them out. Your technique can even be unorthodox. But if it is inadequate, you will not be able to express yourself freely. You will frustrate yourself instead. Good technique allows you to use all the other elements of music at will.
He knelt down and proceeded to make another call as easily as he'd made the first. He never stopped talking during the process. I relaxed on the ground, watching and listening.
Your technique should be at such a high level that you can forget about it. Eventually, you'll even forget about your bass. Only then can you remember how to play music. Think about talking. When you talk, the words are your notes. Your tongue, diaphragm, mouth, teeth, lips, and so on are your instruments. How you use them to push air across your vocal cords and through your lips to form words is your technique, but you rarely think about that.
His coal was still smoking, so I threw some grass on top of it. The grass was moist, which almost put out the coal, but Michael came to the rescue, blowing on it with a couple of short breaths. He had it smoking again within seconds.
When you were a baby, your technique was not adequate enough to allow you to speak like everyone else. You would babble on and on trying to work it out and be understood. Not having the proper control of your instrument caused you to cry.
He frowned comically, as if he was an upset child. I had to laugh.
After many months, you finally developed the control, allowing you to say the things you wanted to say. That made you happy. The feeling of joy encouraged you to learn more.
He stood up smiling, raising his hands into the air.
Notice you did not develop your speaking technique through diligent practice, at least not the type of practice you are familiar with. Your parents didn't lock you in a room and make you work on it 3 hours a day, and they didn't make you take lessons. You learned to speak through a natural process. Musicians could benefit from looking at this process. When learning music, we think we need to concentrate really hard on something until we achieve success. We also think we should lock ourselves in what we call the woodshed for at least a few hours each day and focus on what we are doing. We practice our scales, modes, and techniques over and over until they become second nature. This, we think, is the only way of attaining the level of master musician. I propose a different path.
He bent down over the coal and waved his hand one time, creating a breeze. As he stood back up, the grass burst into flames. My eyes widened. He didn't react.
Do you have to concentrate to speak English? When you are playing music at your best, are you concentrating? Do you want to have to concentrate every time you do anything well? No, you don't.
I was tense, but he seemed at ease. Concentrating hard, I tried to keep up with what he was both doing and saying. Between listening to his words and watching him manipulate the fire, I was getting left behind. He began to speak again, so I did my best to pay attention.
If a policeman walked up to you right now and commanded you to walk a straight line, you would probably have a hard time doing it. Why? Because you would start concentrating on doing it right.
He fell to the ground as if losing his balance. Looking up at me, he continued.
You don't have to concentrate to walk. So when you start trying to concentrate, your body does not like it, and you lose your balance. If you were to do that in front of the policeman, you could end up in jail. And that is exactly what happens to most of us when we try to play music. We allow ourselves to be trapped in the jails of our own minds.
He clenched his fist in front of him, pantomiming being behind bars.
There is a time for concentrating and a time for not concentrating. Concentration is similar to focusing the rays of the sun into one point by use of a magnifying glass. Amazing amounts of heat can be produced by using this method. You used to do it as a kid, am I right?
I smiled but didn't answer. Of course he was right. I thought about the few times I'd played with fire as a kid. I'd always enjoyed starting fires with a magnifying glass. There was something about focusing the sun's rays down to one point that intrigued me. I thought about the possibilities of doing it with one's mind. Michael sat down in a full lotus position before continuing.